the friendship which thus subsisted between some of the English independent ministers and some of the Scottish clergy during the time that the parliamentary army was in Scotland has been differently accounted for. It has been inferred that a number of the protesters were somewhat favorable to independency, among the chief of whom was Mr. Patrick Gillespie. On the other hand, it has been supposed that some of the independent clergy had no decided objection to Presbyterianism, in the form in which that system of ecclesiastical polity existed in Scotland. Dr. Owen, in particular, has been said to have expressly declared this, nay, that he would have thought it an honor to sit as a member in one of her assemblies. There can be no doubt that the differences betwixt some of the Presbyterians and the Independents were not originally so great, as these were afterwards discovered to be, between persons distinguished by the same names. They professed to believe the same great doctrines, and conscientiously preached them, and they differed only in regard to their mode of church government. But even in regard to this, some of the earlier independents were far from differing widely from their Presbyterian brethren. The Reverend Charles Harrell, who, after the death of Dr. Twiss, was made prolocutor in the Westminster Assembly, has been represented to have said, "The difference between us and our brethren who are for independency is nothing so great, as some may conceive. At most, it does but ruffle the fringe, not any way rend the garment of Christ. It is so far from being a fundamental, that it is scarce a material difference." We are informed that Richard Baxter was likewise accustomed to observe, that, if all the Presbyterians had been like Mr. Marshall, and the Independents like Mr. Burroughs, their differences might easily have been compromised. The only part of the country in which any ministers connected with the Church of Scotland appear to have separated from it, and joined themselves to the Independents, was the town or county of Aberdeen. A small work on independency, bearing the title of A Little Stone Out of the Mountain, or Church Order Briefly Opened, which was written by Nicholas Lockyer, who accompanied the English army to Scotland, was printed at Leith in 1652. This was replied to, in a work from the pen of James Wood, professor of theology in St. Andrews, which was printed at Edinburgh in 1654. The title of Professor Wood's publication is, A Little Stone Pretended to Be Out of the Mountain, Tried, and Found to Be a Counterfeit, and see. In that work, Wood animadverts upon a letter from the new Independents of Aberdeen, dated May 1652, and laments that some of them had been for some years ministers of the established church. It is singular enough that in a memoir of that unhappy man, Archbishop Sharp, which was published in his own lifetime and dedicated to himself, it is stated that Provost Jaffrey, who afterwards became a Quaker, was known to declare that Sharp was the first man who had confirmed him in the way of independency. Along with other circumstances, the disunion which prevailed throughout the church, and the causes which gave rise to it, must have had a tendency to mitigate the hostility with which the protesting clergy regarded the army of Cromwell in general, and the effect, at the same time, of recommending them to him and his adherents. The protesters doubted the sincerity of Charles. Though he had subscribed their covenant, they were persuaded he had no real attachment to their church. They were of opinion that, were he once firmly seated on the throne, their civil and religious liberties would be alike endangered. So far, therefore, could they sympathize with the parliamentary general and the soldiers whom he commanded in their opposition to their monarch. The protesters drew off from the army, which after the Battle of Dunbar was embodied, with the concurrence of the king, the parliament, and the commission of the church, for the defense of the monarchy and the liberation of Scotland. This army was recruited with men of every description. Numerous commissions in it were given to known malignants. The success of an army so constituted, the protesters thought, was to be dreaded rather than wished for. Binning and others declared they could not even pray for its success. Here was another point, in regard to which they and the invading army must have felt sympathy with one another, and which must have materially altered their relative position, leading them to assume such an equivocal attitude, that it must have been difficult, even for themselves, to determine whether they were more the friends or the foes of each other. Injustice, however, has been done to the protesters, by representing them to have been Republicans. This was by no means their character as a body, whatever may have been the opinions of individuals among them. One of the most active and able of them was the unfortunate Mr. James Guthrie, minister of Stirling. Though he was executed after the Restoration, for his conceived disloyalty, in opposition, it is believed, to the personal wishes of the king, he never abjured his lawful prince. He wished the royal prerogative to be limited by law, as it afterwards was at the Revolution, but he did not wish it to be abolished. At great personal hazard, Guthrie maintained a public disputation on the subject of the royal authority, in the Church of Stirling, with the noted Hugh Peters, one of Cromwell's chaplains, and in the presence of a number of the parliamentary officers. And in the same place, and near the same period, he showed himself to be a staunch Presbyterian, by engaging in a public discussion with Mr. J. Brown, an Anabaptist, who was chaplain to Colonel Fairfax's regiment. In his speech at his trial, he declared his loyalty in the strongest possible terms, and made the following touching, though unavailing, appeal to his judges. Albeit, it does become me to adore God in the holiness and wisdom of his dispensations, yet I can hardly refrain from expressing some grief of spirit, that my house and family should not only be so many months together cessed by a number of English soldiers, and myself kept from the pulpit, for preaching and speaking against the tender, and incorporating this nation in one commonwealth with England, and that I should thereafter, in time of Oliver Cromwell his usurping the government to himself, under the name of Protector, be delated by some, and challenged by sundry of his council in this nation, for a paper published by me, wherein he was declared to be an usurper, and his government to be usurpation, that I should have been threatened to have been sent to the court, for writing a paper against Oliver Cromwell his usurping the crown of these kingdoms, that I should have been threatened with banishment for concurring in offering a large testimony against the evil of the times, to Richard Cromwell his counsel, immediately after his usurping the government. I say, my lord, it grieves me, that, notwithstanding of all those things, I should now stand indicted before your lordships as intending the eradicating and subverting of the ancient civil government of this nation, and being subservient to that usurper in his designs. The God of heaven knows that I am free of this charge, and I do defy all the world, allowing me justice and fair proceeding, which I hope your lordships will, to make out the same against me. From the case of conscience and from some expressions which Binning uttered under strong excitement, and which were repeated to Principal Bailey, it would appear that his loyalty was somewhat shaken by the passing of the public resolutions, after the Battle of Dunbar, if not before that time, by a conviction of the dissimulation of the king. He probably thought, with the framers of the Western Remonstrance, in which he seems to have concurred, that they would not be justifiable in fighting for Charles, without some additional security being provided for the maintenance of their religious privileges, and unless some adequate restraint were imposed upon the exercise of the royal authority. His dread of arbitrary power is strongly expressed in the case of conscience. The plea of necessity, says he, is but a pretense to cover some design, that under its specious and plausible covering, The power of the land may be engrossed in the hands of malignants, and so by this means, all power and trust may return, as the rivers to the sea or fountain, as they judge the king, that so, in his person, there may be established an unlimited and arbitrary power. That Finning was the author of the case of conscience cannot reasonably be doubted. It was published, in 1693, under the name of Mr. Hugh Binning, sometime professor of philosophy in the University of Glasgow, and thereafter minister of God's Word at Govan. Nor, so far, as can be ascertained, was it denied to be his by any person, at the time of its publication. It was printed in Holland, and although, as has been objected to it, it has not attached to it the name of the printer, nor the name of the place where it was printed, neither have the apologetical relation, the true nonconformist, the apology for, or vindication of, oppressed persecuted ministers, the history of the indulgence, rectius instrundum, the hind let loose, and various other works by Scottish writers, which, for obvious reasons were printed abroad, after the Restoration. In his dying testimony, however, it is declared by Mr. Robert Smith, a graduate of Groningen, that the Reverend James Kidd, who was subsequently minister of Queen's Ferry, was sent to Holland by the Society people to superintend the printing of the Sanquihar Declaration of 1692, and Mr. Hugh Binning's peace against association, that Mr. Kidd was imprisoned for this for a considerable time in Holland, and that, after he obtained his liberty, he and Kidd studied for one session together at the University of Utrecht. 2. It seems almost certain that the manuscript must have been obtained from the widow of the author, or from his son, both of whom were living when the pamphlet first appeared, and both of whom were intimately connected with the Society people. At a general meeting of the Society people at Edinburgh, the 28th of May, 1683, it was resolved that Mr. John Binning should be desired to wait upon a school, for teaching some young men, and for his pains he was to have £25 Scots per quarter. According to this resolution, Mr. Binning did teach Latin to some of these young men for some time. And in a letter from the Reverend James Renwick, to Sir Robert Hamilton of Preston, dated September 26, 1683, and printed from the original, he says, "Likewise, according to your direction, I challenged Mrs. Binning upon her intimacy with your sister, but she says there is no ground for it, and I think not such as your honor apprehends. As also I challenged her upon the commendation she gave Joe Wilson, in her letter unto you, but she says she had not then seen his testimony, and was sorry, when she saw it, it was so contrary both to her thoughts, and to her commendation of him." This letter is curtailed in the printed collection of Renwick's letters, and the passage in it, which refers to Mrs. Binning, is only partially quoted by John Howie of Lochgoyne, in a note to Shield's Faithful Contendings. 3. A copy of the original manuscript is at present in my possession, belonging to David Lang, Esquire, Edinburgh, which, so far as one can judge from the orthography and handwriting, must have been written near the time of the author. It formed part of a collection of papers chiefly of that period, of which some are docketed by Sir Archibald Johnston of Warriston. It is entitled The Tractate, proving that there is still a Malig party, and that we should not associate with them, written in January 1651. The writer of the Life of Binning was of opinion that as Mr. Binning died in the year 1653, and the pamphlet was not published till the year 1693, some of the protesters would have published it, in the course of that period, had they known that Mr. Binning was the author of it. But various circumstances may have occurred to prevent its being made public at an earlier period. And although it was not printed, it may have been read by many in manuscript. I cannot but think, though he has mistaken the Christian name of the author, that it is to Hugh Binning's case of conscience that Samuel Colville, the ungodly son of a pious mother, alludes. In that mass of ribaldry and indecency, the Whig's supplication, when describing the library of the Covenanters, he says, "Some reads the cases of Richard Binning." This mock poem of Colville was printed for the first time in the year 1681, but according to the poet's own statement, it was circulated in MS previous to this. 4. The views of Binning are known to have accorded with the general strain of the case of conscience. The object of his tractate was to expose and counteract the purposes and proceedings of the resolutioners. This was likewise Binning's object in the part he acted, on different occasions, in the Presbytery of Glasgow. In the minutes of that ecclesiastical court, he is always found opposed to the resolutioners, and cooperating with Principal Gillespie, and the other protesters. This will account for the tone in which Bailey speaks of him. "Behold," says he in a letter from Perth, 2 January, 1651, "the next Presbytery day, when I am absent, Mr. Patrick Gillespie causes read again the commission's letter, and had led it so, that by the elders' votes, the men of greatest experience and wisdom of our presbytery were the two youngest we had, Mr. Hugh Binning and Mr. Andrew Morton." The following fact proves that the opponents, as well as the friends, of Binning in the presbytery, knew him to be decidedly averse to the public resolutions. On the 28th of May, 1651, Mr. Patrick Gillespie, Mr. John Carstairs, and Mr. Hugh Binning were chosen by the presbytery to be their representatives at the ensuing General Assembly. But Mr. Robert Ramsay, and the other resolutioners who were present, protested against their election, on the ground that they had not received notice of what was intended to be done, that Mr. Gillespie and Mr. Binning were opposed to the public resolutions in church and state, and that the commission of the church might yet give them some directions as to this matter. Accordingly, when the assembly met at St. Andrews, from protesting against which is an illegal assembly, the protesters derived their name, among the numerous commissions which were objected to on that occasion, were those of Mr. Patrick Gillespie and Mr. Hugh Binning, the resolutioners in the presbytery having, it appears, made a different appointment of commissioners, at a meeting of their own. So much opposed, indeed, was Binning to the public resolutions that we find him, on the 20th of June 1651, protesting against the insertion of a letter, from the commission of the church regarding them, in the presbytery minutes. And on the 20th of August, we in like manner perceive him voting against the registration, in the minutes of the presbytery, of various acts of the assembly, which had met at St. Andrews and Dundee, in July, 1651, because yet were sinful in themselves, and came from an unlawful and null assembly. But this is not all Binning wrote. Some animadversions upon a paper initialed, "No separation from the army," and see. These, it is believed, were never printed. The manuscript copy, which I have perused, is in the handwriting of Mr. David Anderson, the clerk, or amanuensis of Sir Archibald Johnston of Warriston, who has written on it with his own hand, "Mr. H. Binney, his reply to M.D. Dixon." The title itself of the manuscript indicates the views of the author. But the summary of its style and reasoning, and those of the case of conscience, is very evident.
Although he was thus led under an imperative sense of duty to enter the lists of controversy with Mr. David Dixon, who was now professor of theology in the University of Edinburgh, but who at the time of the induction of the author, being a member of the presbytery, had presided at his ordination, it is pleasant to observe that even when expressing himself most strongly, Binning treats his former colleague in the University of Glasgow with uniform courtesy and respect. In one place he says, "If I knew not the integrity of the writer, I could hardly spare a hard censure of him, either for dissembling what he knows, or not reading what he condemns. But I will think neither, but rather that he is too confident of his own assertion." In another place he exclaims, "Alas! Should a divine speak so? If a carnal politician had said it, I had not thought it strange, but a godly tender man to speak in these terms.
Should it be asked how this manuscript has not formed a part of the present collection of the works of the author, the reason is simply this: it was not conceived that the degree of interest felt at this distant period, in the controversy to which it relates, would warrant its publication, and more particularly as anyone, wishing to obtain a knowledge of the principles and the policy which it advocates, may be gratified by consulting some of the numerous pamphlets and manifestos which were printed at the time. Along with the Case of Conscience, the present edition of the works of the author includes the Treatise of Christian Love, first printed at Edinburgh in 1743, and several sermons upon the most important subjects of practical religion, which were printed for the first time at Glasgow in 1760. Neither of these is contained in the quarto edition of Binning's works that was published in 1768, at Glasgow. That was a mere reprint of the edition of 1735, which issued from the Edinburgh Press. In his address to the reader, the publisher of the Treatise on Christian Love says, "This treatise, with a great number of excellent sermons, preached by this able minister of the gospel, many of which have never been printed, in a manuscript in folio, was found in the late Reverend Mr. Robert Woodrow, minister of Eastwood, his library." The editor of the Practical Sermons, however, informs us, in his preface, that the manuscript from which the elegant and judicious Treatise of Christian Love was first printed, was in his hand. And he adds, "As Mr. Woodrow wrote large collections upon the lives of our most eminent reformers, which he designed to publish, if he had lived longer, so the lives and letters of Mr. John Knox, who was commonly styled the reformer, is now preparing for the press, to which will be added some of his essays on religious subjects, never before printed. If the publication of Mr. Knox's life be duly encouraged, some more lives of other ministers in that period will be transcribed and revised, for the benefit of the public, who desire to have them printed. Hence we are led to conclude that those additional works of Binning found their way to the press through the Reverend Robert Woodrow, minister of Eastwood, the son and successor of the historian." The preface to the Practical Sermons is dated Browsterland, September 12, 1760. This is the name of a place in the parish of Kilbride, in the county of Lanark, to which it has been ascertained the son of the historian retired, for a short time, after resigning his cure in the year 1758. I observe, likewise, that a letter now before me, written in the year 1806, by the Reverend Drive James Woodrow, minister of Stevenston, the youngest son of the historian, and addressed to the Reverend Drive Robert Finlay, of the University of Glasgow, contains a statement, which, in the absence of more direct evidence, may be referred to as furnishing us with some other grounds for believing that the anonymous writer of the Browsterland preface was the retired minister of Eastwood. The statement is, that the writer of the letter, who was much younger than his two brothers, the ministers of Tarbolton and Eastwood, had heard that they had some thoughts of publishing Buchanan and Knox's lives, written by their father. It is to be regretted that none of Binning's writings were published by himself, or in his own lifetime. The indulgence of the reader is on this account justly claimed for them. We cannot be certain that the author's meaning has been always correctly expressed. And everyone accustomed to composition must be aware that in transcribing, or revising what has been previously written, even with some degree of care, the change of a single expression, or the insertion of an additional word, or the transposition of a solitary clause in a sentence, often makes the meaning of the writer infinitely clearer, and gives a new character altogether to his style. But we ought also to bear in mind that the following sermons were prepared for a country audience, and that they were the ordinary weekly production of a very young clergyman, struggling with bad health, and burdened with the performance of various other arduous duties. Many, I have no doubt, will think this apology for the offer unnecessary.
The facts now stated, however, when taken into consideration, must increase their admiration of Binning, his copiousness, his variety, both in regard to matter and style, the beauty of his imagery, the grandeur of his conceptions, his felicitous application of the language of Scripture, being all the more wonderful when viewed in connection with the unfavorable circumstances in which his sermons were composed. The discourses of Binning are unquestionably a very favorable specimen of the talents and learning, as well as of the piety of the clergy of Scotland in his day. At the same time, that class of men have not had justice done to them. Adopting the tone of their persecutors, it was long the practice of court sycophants, and others, to ridicule and calumniate them. Their sermons were burlesqued, sometimes through ignorance, and sometimes through malice. Many of them were printed from the notes, or imperfect recollections of pious but illiterate persons. And if a minister was known to possess any portion of eccentricity, absurd sayings were invented for him, and when, at any time, a singular statement, or an uncouth expression, was heard to proceed from him, it was seized upon with avidity, treasured up, and repeated as an illustration of the kind of preaching that was common among the ministers of his church.
It is almost inconceivable, therefore, how many, even among the intelligent classes of society, in the present day, have been led, most unwarrantably, to form their estimate of the literary qualifications of the ministers of Scotland, in the 17th century, from the grotesque Pocmity sermon of the Reverend James Rowe, minister at Monivard and Strachan, from Hobbes's Behemoth, from the unpolished and authenticated discourses of some of the field preachers, or from that collection of profanity and obscenity entitled Scotch Presbyterian Eloquence Displayed.